Welcome to Hometown Alaska. This is Kathleen McCoy, your host. And today we're going to take a little trip back in time. We're going to go back to 1935. We're going to be talking about the Matsu colonists who came up for a new start in the Matanuska Valley. It was a New Deal promise. It was an amazing story and one that we know about but maybe don't know that much about. But we're going to be very lucky to hear from the daughter of colonists, Jerry Keeling. Hello, Jerry.
Good afternoon there, Kathleen.
We're talking to you from the Valley, and we'll be talking all through the hour with you about stories from that time period and even some of the efforts to keep that history alive today. And I want to let folks know that in the second half hour, we're going to be hearing from Eileen Probasco, who is the chief planner for the Matanuska Borough, because we're going to also talk about sort of how the Valley has changed, what's going on in the Valley today. But we're going to start with the roots back in 1935. So we'll hear from Jerry throughout the hour, and I encourage people who have questions or stories that they want to share. If you lived through that era, we would love to hear from you today. Or if you have questions, you can put those questions to Jerry, and we'll try to answer them for you. And Eileen has sort of more contemporary history in the Valley, but she's also lived there since she was a young girl and knows how growth and change has really impacted and influenced life in the Valley. So I want our callers to know we want to hear from you. The number here is 550-8433. That's how you can call into Hometown Alaska and, you know, ask questions about the Matanuska colonies or just share a story. Statewide, there's a free toll-free number, and it's 1-888-353-5752. And if you're shy about the phone or you can't do it or you're traveling and you've got your iPhone, you can send us an email, hometownalaska@ksKA.org. And that's another way that we can communicate and maybe read your messages on the air. I want to remind our listeners to Hometown Alaska that we'll be rebroadcasting again tonight. It'll be a recording, so you can't call in or email in tonight. This is your only chance between 2 and 3 today. And one more tidbit for you. We've got a great website, kska.org, and you'll hear us talk about videos, historical videos, books, a new book that just came out this year to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the colonists. We have that information on kska.org, so folks can just come to our website, find the Hometown Alaska link, and you'll just find everything there. So don't worry about trying to write down titles or the names of DVDs or things like that. So anyway, remember the phone number. It's 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752, calling from statewide. And of course, there's the email address, hometownalaska@ksKA.org. So, Jerry.
Yes, ma'am.
Jerry and I met for the first time, I think it was last Sunday. I drove up to the Valley, and I went to the Colony House Museum, and there was Jerry to be my guide. And we sat at the dining room table, and we shared. She shared stories with me. So I wanted to start with your family. You weren't actually here yet. Your mom was pregnant, and you had a sister who was 11.
Yes.
So you weren't there from day one, but you were there shortly after. So where did your family come from?
My family were living in a small farm just outside Duluth, Minnesota, when they applied to be a part of the Matanuska Colony Project in 1935. So Mama was from northern Minnesota. Daddy was from Sioux City, Iowa. They had met and married in Duluth, and both were first-generation American.
First-generation Americans, and brave at that. I'm going to go to the phones, Jerry, because we already have a caller.
That is superb.
Lynette, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Well, hello. How are you, Kathleen?
I'm fine, and it's so sweet for you to call. Why don't you tell folks what you just produced in honor of the colonists' 75th anniversary?
I can do that. And hello, Jerry. How are you?
Hi, Lynette. I'm doing fine, and you the same, I hope.
I certainly am.
Okay.
I'm fortunate enough to know Jerry from many places in the Valley, but Lori Kirker and I are owners of Alaskana Books in Palmer. And we were able to put together a book commemorating the 75th anniversary of the Matanuska Colony. And we own, as I said, Alaskana Books, and we used a lot of our reference materials. We have over 25,000 books on Alaska, and a lot of them are on the Matsu Valley. So we put together new photographs that had not been seen yet, some wonderful things from old magazines from the 30s, and some pamphlets that were government pamphlets. And we put it together in a very short period of time. And we had some big shoes to fill because Britt Lively had done the 50th and the 60th commemorative book. So we're following in her shoes.
Now, I was when I was at the museum with Jerry on Sunday, I saw some of these books, and I think I even saw yours there. I bet many of them are not in circulation anymore. Yours is, of course, but I wonder if some of the older ones, the 50th and the 60th, are not around anymore.
We have a few of the copies of them, and they are hard to get a hold of, but they're wonderful. Britt spent a lot of time in interviewing the colonists, so you get some dynamic stories there. Ours was put together more or less on a scrapbook form, so the photographs are very strong, and Lori Kirker did an awful lot with the text involved with it. And both of us worked rather magic kinds of things in a very short period of time. We were college roommates and managed to stay up several times, all-nighters in college, and now in our 60s, we ended up doing all-nighters to finish the book. But we're rather proud of it.
Oh, it's really nice. I got a chance to look at it. And, you know, among the documents that are in there was a long list of all the tracks and what families started out on what tracks. And this was a government project, so there were a lot of photographers here. There was a lot of coverage. So there's a lot of documentation, right, Lynette?
Yes, there is, and my background is in art, and we even had a gentleman from the Chicago Tribune come up and actually do cartoons of what was happening. He came up on the train, and so there are cartoons of him on the on the ship, and the gentleman's name is Hal Dunahay, and those I don't think have been in print since the mid 30s.
Wow!
So we were very happy to put that in.
Right, that's a real treasure. Now, did these things come? Did you buy the Alaskana Bookstore in Anchorage?
Okay, from Jean Short. Lori bought it almost 10 years ago now and moved it out to the valley. And we have the strangest hours in North America. We're only open on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And Lori did this to give the customers who were used to the bookstore being with Jean in Anchorage so that they could come out to the valley on weekends.
Oh, that's great. Lynette, you talked about the cartoons. That was a surprise. Those haven't been in circulation since maybe the 30s, you think. What were some other surprises? Jerry, if you have seen this book and you had some eye-openers when you saw it, I'd love to hear what were some of the surprises in that book.
Well, one of the things was the periodicals that we were able to find, and their description of the Roosevelt era and what was done and how things were done. it was kind of interesting.
You know what surprised me? I want to let people know about this DVD called Alaska Far Away, because it's a very excellent storytelling version of this. And what really got me were the newsreels at the beginning and how stark the Depression was and how, you know, these colonists, Jerry, they came from Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And this was an area in the northern part of the U.S. that they called it the cutover.
Yes.
I learned all this from the DVD. And it was supposed to be farmland, but it wasn't really productive farmland.
Well, this is true. The government had rather initiated the cutover process for those three states in the northern regions because they thought perhaps then that area could be turned into a good quality farmland. But the topsoil level was so limited, it was rocky and just not productive to turn into farmland. So it was kind of a letdown for that direction that the government had envisioned.
Right. And, you know, the amount of media attention the plan got was very interesting, too. Lynette, you probably are aware of all of this from your research, but it was amazing how, you know, it was almost like the whole country was sort of watching these 200 families. And they were described as the hope for the nation, you know, because it was going to the frontier. It was opening up. It was a can-do kind of, you know, problem solving and starting over. And so there were tons of newspaper stories and newsreels, really dramatic newsreels. One of the stories from the DVD was a family in one of these three states where the reporter came up and said, "Well, I want to get some footage of you leaving." And they said, "Well, we're not really ready to go yet." And he said, "Well, just pile some stuff on this flatbed truck and drive away, and I'll take your picture driving away." And they did, and that was in the newsreel. But the family ended up saying, you know, "We didn't leave for another week and a half." So the media were all over this. There was a writer named Rex Beach. I'm not sure where he was from, but he was pretty critical of it. Do you know, Lynette?
He was also a fiction writer. So, you know, you can take that with perhaps a grain of salt. People are entitled to double opinions, you know.
Oh, sure, yeah. There were definitely the pros, and then there were definitely the skeptics who were thinking, "This is ridiculous. It'll never work." So let's edge on down the road a little bit. Jerry, can you tell a little bit about how those families moved from Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota to the West Coast?
I surely will. The first contingent was the group of 68 families from Minnesota. One of them actually was from Oklahoma and had traveled into southern Minnesota to travel with those state families. They traveled by train to San Francisco, departing the St. Paul train station on April 25th, 1935. And as that train wended its way across country, it would perhaps add a boxcar or two, maybe, of canned goods. It might be kegs of nails. It might be mattresses for army cots, who knows what. But the government is stockpiling all the materials that are going to be needed to get this project going in Alaska. And so the Minnesotans traveled to San Francisco, disembarked after a 2 or 3 day hoopla celebration with the city, and sailed on that army troop transport ship, the St. Mihiel, leaving for Seward, Alaska on May 1, 1935. The ship disembarked them in Seward, Alaska, which is the southern terminus of our railroad from original railroad construction. And then the ship did a turnaround and headed for Seattle, because Seattle was to be the departure point for the families from Wisconsin and Michigan. Seattle had been kind of perplexed and fussing about the fact that the government hoopla from the first state's families was all in San Francisco, whereas Seattle knew that they were the financial kernel in the corn, the nut of economy for the territory of Alaska.
They wanted to know some of the action.
The other two families headed for Seward, right across the Gulf of Alaska in May 1935 with choppy waters awaiting.
Jerry, I want to give folks a chance to hear our phone numbers again, just because the history is just so rich and you've got so much right at your fingertips there. If people have questions about this, it's call Hometown Alaska at 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752 statewide, or send us an email to hometownalaska@kska.org. Jerry, I want to go back.
Can I interrupt?
Oh, sure, Lynette.
Half a second.
You bet.
The actual date of the colony days, we opened our bookstore and had many, many of the colonists and colonist kids and grandkids who came up, and we had what we like to refer to as a reverse book signing, where the colonist kids came in and signed the book that we had next to their family plot, which was really interesting.
Nice.
And we had one family, the Hess family, who came in, and they had Mr. Hess, who was a colony kid, correct, Jerry?
Yes, that's correct.
And his son and his grandson, and we said to the grandson, who was about 13, why don't you sign, too? And the kid got a big smile on his face and says, oh, I'd love to do that. That means I'm history, too.
That's great. That's great.
Isn't it a wonderful story? I just love it. Well, I'm going to hang up, but I did want to ask Jerry a question.
Yes.
If you could give us some more information. I am an old, used-up school teacher, as is Lori Kirker, and could you tell us a little bit about the education?
You mean for the parents or the children? For the children. Part of the original planning of the community was the draw blueprint, specifying the construction of a lovely school building, which actually, after at least three expansion processes, is now housing our borough government. But that building was begun in construction 1935, that summer and fall. In 1936, it graduated its first senior class, and there was one person in the class, a colonist son named Earl Berry. And by the next autumn, September of 1936, it was home base to about 300, and I'm going to estimate between 340 and 370 children, grades 1 through 12. And I, for one of many colony kids and others, went to school in that building for grades 1 through 12. I have lots of good memories about it.
Now, didn't they go to schools at the very beginning in one of the train cars?
There was a real variation in learning those very early months, yes. There was a railroad car, or maybe more than one, but at least one, parked along the tracks, I would say, between where the depot is now, crossing Evergreen, and then up between that and Fireweed. And then there were classes that were held in the various homes and the various camps where the colonist families were clustered, either in their tents yet or in the neighborhood of where they lived. And the classes were held first in one person's home, and then it might rotate a week later to the next neighbor's home, because at that point, still in the first September of 35, the houses were still under construction, but more so was the school. And so kind of rotating around, the teachers would ride horseback or however they managed to get to where they were going. From class, they go out, meet the students of that neighborhood, give class assignments, do their teaching process, and depart for a week. And those youngsters were on their own to get their homework done before next week's teacher appearance.
Wonderful. Thank you, ladies. I really appreciate the opportunity to chit-chat with you this afternoon.
Well, thanks for calling in, Lynette, and I want to remind people you're one of the authors of the scrapbook, Matanuska Colony's 75th Anniversary Scrapbook, that's available in the Valley now. So thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Take care.
See you around town, Lynette.
And I'd like to go to Bridget. Bridget, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Bridget Preston, and I am the current president of the Palmer Arts Council. And I just wanted to call in and let you know that our organization has a copy of a book called 200 Were Chosen. And this is a play that was written in 1936 by E.P. Conkle, and this was part of the WPA Federal Theater Project. This gentleman wrote a play, and this play showed on Broadway for about 36 shows. And anyway, we have a copy of this book. It's sort of a rare book. There are only two copies of it in the state of Alaska.
Wow.
And one of them is up at University of Alaska Fairbanks, and the other one is in the Alaska State Library. And so our organization is going to be donating this book to the Palmer Public Library sometime in September. We're going to have a little event. And I've been doing some research on this book and finding out about its history on Broadway to the extent that I can. There's not a whole lot of information. But anyway, to our knowledge, this show has never been produced or performed in the state of Alaska. And, you know, it's... When we have our little event to give the book to the library, we're hoping that people who have an interest in this story would come and participate because, you know, we want to see if there is the collective will to, you know, have this show created and performed. It does have a cast of a bit large cast, which was the goal of the Federal Theater Project, to employ a lot of people. So if any group were to decide to do it, it would be sort of a major undertaking. But anyway, it's just another little interesting part of the Colony Project.
Yeah. And Bridget, do you know if there are any photographs of the production? I don't imagine there's any footage of the production, but have you ever seen any?
Definitely no footage. In the book, there is on the front plate, there is a black and white photo from the New York cast. And that's the only picture that I have seen. I've been calling Library of Congress and various other universities on the East Coast where a lot of the federal theater stuff is, you know, they have collections.
Right.
And unfortunately, there are no playbills or anything like that that anybody can locate. But
I'm just thinking that, you know, this was just the 50th anniversary of the state, and there mm-hmm. were a bunch of locally written and locally produced.
Correct.
And it's just a shame that this one didn't bubble up there. That might have been an opportunity. We'll have to look for another opportunity, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, we feel, you know, I mean, our group has, along with the Palmer Museum, we've been sort of talking about this for...
we just lost Bridget. We might get her back. But Chuck, are you there?
Chuck Logson with
Hi,
the
Chuck.
Palmer Historical Society.
Welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Thank you.
And tell us about your historical society.
Yes, I was listening to the earlier discussion, and this is really a fascinating story. And I thought just to give you a little perspective from the, you know, strictly the historical perspective. Really, the colony effectively created the town of Palmer. Before the colonists arrived, the area, the Palmer itself, was not much. There was a watering stop for the trains that were hauling coal from the up around Sutton, Moose Creek, and Eska to Anchorage, hay fields of the earlier settlers. But I think there was a what you would call a roadhouse, and not much else. John Buggy was the main one of the main inhabitants, along with M.D. Snodgrass, but there wasn't a lot going on. Then all of a sudden, one day in May in 1935, a train pulls up and 1,000 people get off. And it all started from there, and really, I think... I'm an economist, so from that perspective, really, it was the federal spending on the initial infrastructure. You were talking about the schools, but a lot of additional land was cleared, housing was constructed, In addition to the school, a hospital, there were warehouses. A community was suddenly transplanted into the Matanuska Valley. And although ultimately the utopian envision, or the collective agricultural utopia that was envisioned by the planners, didn't turn out, but it did start the roots of a permanent and robust community. And I would have to tell you, you mentioned the movie, and I can really recommend the Alaska Faraway movie. It is a story of the Depression. It is a story of Alaska, and it's entertainment. It's good drama,
and it tells
if people are interested. It's a great movie.
It doesn't. It doesn't paint an overly rosy picture. It seems to really deal with the ups and the downs that the colonists experienced. And the end of the film really goes into some, you know, serious detail about folks who started to have some problems with the cooperative. They didn't. They were sort of entrepreneurial spirited, and they got a little restless. I think it was Walter Pipel, and ended up suing the Department of Interior, trying to break his contract. Right.
Yes, that's exactly right. And what happened, people had tried to establish agriculture in the valley earlier on. What they always lacked was a local demand for the products. Obviously, you got to sell to somebody. And what really, I think, saved the whole deal was World War II came along, and suddenly the nation recognized Alaska's strategic importance, and they opened the bases in Anchorage, and suddenly you have a local demand for ag products. And the colony infrastructure was here, the people were here, the farmers, and instead of the sort of collective utopia that had been envisioned to save people from rural poverty in the States, you ended up with essentially a farming structure that was basically provided for by entrepreneurial farmers, which would be, you know, the model that Walter Pipel actually started out on when he was suing the federal government way back in the late 30s.
But another interesting thing that comes out in this DVD, Faraway Alaska, which you can find on our website, is the idea that the farmers' cooperative kind of gave rise to, you know, the banking and utility facilities in the valley today. They were the model or the inspiration, so that there are cooperatives in the valley today that kind of took their start from the farmers' cooperative.
That is indeed true, and those programs were, guess what, started by federal employees who were working in the valley with the colony. The credit union, for instance, so that was it was an idea that a fellow who was a manager at the co-op in town thought would make a good one here. And, of course, the REA was a national program for bringing electricity to the rural areas of the U.S. And guess what? With the notion of a cooperative business plan and the movement, it transplanted very well to the valley, and you are exactly right. That's another one of the legacies of the colony.
Right. Well, Chuck, thank you so much for calling in, and I want folks to know that the Palmer Historical Society really is responsible for this Colony House Museum. Am I right?
Yes, it's the historical. I would say it's our greatest tangible asset is our little museum, and along with Jerry Keeling, who is running it for us. I would encourage people to stop by if they're in Palmer, and we're open Tuesdays through Saturdays, 10 until 4. It's really a nice place, and you know, there are a number of books. We have a number of them at the museum as well. I think Evangeline Atwood wrote one specifically about the colony called We Shall Be Remembered. There's a history professor from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Orlando Miller, who wrote a very, very good history. And then there's another one by Don Irwin, who was one of the early managers of the colony called the Colorful Matanuska Valley. So
I'm going to remind our listeners that we've got those books listed on our website at ksk.org. So,
okay.
Thanks a lot, Chuck, for calling in. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Kathleen McCoy on Hometown Alaska.
missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the show repeats tonight at 10. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking phone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, you can also find a copy of today's Hometown Alaska online at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. This is your host, Kathleen McCoy. Our topic today is the Matanuska colonists, and we've been on the phone. We've been talking with Jerry Keeling, who is the daughter of Matanuska colonists. Hi, Jerry.
Hello, Kathleen.
And we're going to be joined in our second half hour by Eileen Probasco. Hello, Eileen.
Good afternoon.
Eileen is the chief of planning for the Matsu Borough, and so she deals with growth and change, but she also has a really interesting sort of family story about, she was not a colonist, her family came later, but she remembers the Valley when it was quite different than it is today, and she's going to share a little bit of that with us. Eileen, let's start with your family and a little bit of the experience of moving into the Valley. How old were you?
Well, I was 13 years old when we moved to Palmer, and that was in 1971. And it's interesting because we arrived in downtown Palmer on July 17th of 1971, so it's been 39 years, I guess, 39 years ago that we arrived this month.
Wow. And you described it to me as kind of the reverse of what it is today, Palmer being the heavyweight and Wasilla just a wide spot in the road.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Palmer was the bigger town. Wasilla was just a sleepy town alongside of the road. The Parks Highway had just been completed within a couple of years before that. And I remember Teelan's being right there at the corner where the Tesoro or Holiday is right now, and just a couple of buildings. But it was a smaller town of the two, for sure.
And where did your family live exactly?
Well, we lived in Palmer. We lived in the city for a while, and then shortly after we got here and kind of got settled, we bought some property out on the Palmer-Wasilla Highway and started to build our home.
I just want to interrupt for a moment and give callers our phone number, because we've sort of broadened our topic just a little bit to not only the colonists, but even a little more sort of marching through history up in the Valley as time changed and the Valley changed. You can call us at 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752 or send us an email to hometownalaska@kska.org. So anyway, returning to you, Eileen, you talked a little bit about how you left the Valley in 1980. Tell us a little bit about that and what your return was like.
Well, my husband and I got married shortly after high school, and we had he had a job opportunity with Fish and Game in Kodiak. So he kind of drugged me kicking and screaming over there. And, we were going to stay for about 5 years, and it ended up being 20. So, of course, during those 20 years, we had come back regularly to visit our family and stuff, most of which were in Palmer area. But as we, so we noticed some of the change a little bit, but when we finally moved back to Palmer in 2000 and started looking for a place to, buy a home or buy some property and build, we really started to notice how significantly different it was in the traffic and the amount of, just the amount of change that had occurred in those 20 years. So.
Yeah, I saw a statistic about the number of people in the Valley in 1970 and then today. Do you have those numbers? I think it was something like 6,000 in 1970 and like 88,000 today.
That sounds right. I don't have them in front of me right now, but yeah,
actually, maybe I could add to that a little.
Sure.
When Evelyn Thompson was the borough clerk, and she was the first clerk for the borough, she said that there were 6,509 people in the borough after the 1970 national census. So here we are today, 40 years later, the census just being completed. And I believe the figure for the borough, is it not, Eileen, something like 88,000?
Yes, that's what I've heard as well. That sounds
okay.
Right.
And actually, it might be fun to tell people how big the Valley is. I mean, they're familiar with Palmer. If you don't live in the Valley, you know of Palmer, you know of Wasilla, you might know of Houston. But really, how big is the Valley?
Well, the valley size is equated to the area size of the state of West Virginia. So it's really quite a broad area going from Mount McKinley to the north up to Lake Louise to the east, quite spread out and ever so beautiful, wouldn't anybody say?
Yes. And, you know, we're talking with Jerry Keeling, the daughter of a Matanuska colonist, and Eileen Probasco, the chief of planning for the Matsu Borough. Eileen, I want to ask you, when you moved into the Valley in the 70s, were you aware of the colonists? And, you know, did they have sort of a footprint in the Valley that has just come through the years? How were you aware of them?
I was aware of them through some of my classmates because they were family members of some of the colonists, of course, with the priests and the Ballins and many of those familiar names. And I went to school with many of them, but I didn't really understand the significance of the colonist project until many years later, of course.
And I want to get Jerry Keeling a chance to talk about this because when I met her Sunday up at the Colony House Museum, we got to talking about the spirit of the colonists and what that was about. And I would love to hear you talk a little bit about that, Jerry Keeling.
Well, I hope I don't go on too lengthily here. I just would like for people to be aware that this colony project was only one of 100 FDR communities. There were 100 others in the South 48 states, 99 others, and we made number 100. To say that it was a very bonding experience would be quite an understatement. When the families came up here in 1935, 204 families, a total of about 900 people with the children, they left their homes, their families, their grandparents, their neighbors and friends and classmates so far behind, and to come to this quite rural area that long ago, 75 years ago plus now, was just a very faraway distance for them to travel. When you consider no Seward Highway, no Parks Highway, no Glen Highway, no Alaska Highway, no air transportation to Alaska. The way to come to Alaska was by ship to Seward and by train into the interior, however far your journey took you. So quite a different state of affairs between then and now.
A bit like landing on the moon, wouldn't you say?
Well, actually, that was the perspective that I asked my mother's sister about in 1984, because the moon was about the furthest thing away I could dream of in 1984, and my Auntie Tina responded. She said, oh, it seemed even further. She said, we didn't think we would ever see one another again.
Wow. And I want to tell people a little bit about how families were chosen. Obviously, they were families that needed a new start. We know that, and we know from the history books that social workers were involved in screening families. And I just want to share with people this little bit of the criteria. There were five criteria that families needed to meet. And they were these criteria. They had to be honest-to-God farmers, and that was in quotes, honest-to-God farmers. They needed to be couples ages 25 to 35. They needed to be physically and mentally strong and be possessed of the pioneer spirit. They needed to be an average-sized family, and I know from doing a little bit of research, there was one family that had 11 children, so that was a bit more than average, I guess.
Yes, for sure.
That would be the Bowen family?
Yes, that's correct. They traveled here with 11 children. Now, there was one other family that later on had 11 children, but only traveled, I believe, with four. So.
Uh-huh. And the fifth criteria, so I finished this, was just that they had to be the Nordic type, fitted by habit to adjust to the Alaska environment. So that's sort of interesting.
I'm curious, where did that whole tad of information come from?
That's actually in the video, Far Away Alaska. It's actually, you actually can see the document that the social workers were working with.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, and of course we do know that not everybody really had the skills. You know, a lot of people did because they stayed, but I think I saw a statistic that in the first year, maybe up to maybe 25 families might have left.
I think that figure is quite close because initially there were 204 families that first year up to the end of 1935, 173 homes were constructed. So that pretty well gives you that figure.
Right. And I'm going to go to the phones. We have a call. Erin, you're on Hometown Alaska.
Oh, hello. Hi, Mom. This is Erin Terwilliger.
Erin, you dear number four daughter. Hi, darling.
Hi, everybody.
Did your mom make you call in?
Pardon me?
Did your mom make you call in?
No. I actually found out through my cousin on Facebook that my mom was going to be on the radio today talking about the colonists. And I'm like, ooh-wee, I'm tuning in.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, so do you want to tell us a story about being the daughter of a colonist?
Oh, well, you know what? Overall, Kathleen, a few minutes ago you had asked my mom about what was the spirit of the colonists and what was that like for them to come so far away and this and that. And I was just really flooded with the overwhelming sense that as the heritage that they have passed on, many of the families have persevered through just the toughest of times. They raised their children, and those children raised their children there. Now I am proud to be raising my children in the state of Alaska. I live in South Anchorage, but Palmer is, of course, originally my home. And my girls are very much aware of the heritage that their great-grandparents lived and have passed on. And it's just this amazing spirit of tenacity. They just... you know, here in Alaska now, we're just so, things are so much more available to us. You know, fast food, we just have this, you know, the city just tends to run on this attitude that it's me for me. Get out of my way, and I have the right to whatever. And yet, way back then, and it wasn't even that long ago, just my grandparents and the families that came with them, they were back to the basics. And I love that I can share that and just know that just because it's hard doesn't mean it's bad, and that perseverance pays, all those good things that that just make me proud to know that my grandparents were among them.
That's exactly what Jerry was really talking about. Jerry Keeling was talking about the other day about sort of being happy with what you've got, being able to do with what you've got, finding happiness and pleasure in small things instead of big things. But, you know, some of the rush that you describe sort of makes me think of Eileen. Eileen, are you with us still?
Yes, I am.
And because when in our conversations, we talked a bit about the changes in the valley and some of the pressures that so much growth has brought to the valley. And you told a couple of family stories of encountering that growth yourself, starting a house and finding out that what you thought was your driveway was actually a public road, you know, different things like that. So I thought it might be a good idea to pull you in and let you address a little bit of what Erin is talking about. There's a kind of nostalgia for this simpler time, but there's more of us here and we have needs, and maybe we can draw on those roots a little bit to solve some of the problems.
Yeah, I think that the brief story that I will share about growth and change and stuff is like when, even during a short period of time from when my family moved here until my husband and I got married and started our own home, we had some property on what we thought was our along Palmerwasso Highway, but this long driveway that we thought was just our long driveway. Well, we came to find out that it was not really a long driveway. We had, you know, been given permission to construct this long driveway within a section line easement, which, you know, eventually became 49th State Street. And we, at one point along the way of constructing our home, we got a message from the borough that said, well, you need to come to this public meeting because we are considering putting the borough landfill at the end of this road. And we were just aghast, like, how can they do that? This is just open borough land, and we want it to stay the way it is. And so, of course, even in that short period of time, that was my first experience with making yourself aware of what going on around you and what could potentially happen around you after you, you know, even after you've put down your roots and built your home and just all the changes that occur. So.
Right, right. And I even saw this in some of the letters from colonists. There were examples on the Alaska Faraway DVD that their letters to the government saying they wanted out. And a lot of them were, I didn't know it was going to be like this. So they weren't as up to speed as they probably needed to be.
Yeah, I think that that's one thing that I hear from many people in the things that we do in planning every day is they bought something expecting it to be the same for forever where they were living and then of course recognizing that that's really not going to happen. There's as the population increases, the need for improved roads and more schools and additional public facilities, it just happens and it's just the same story I hear at every meeting. It's like we want things just to not change, and that's a tough place to be.
And yet you can't not change, right?
Right.
I know we talked a little bit about schools being a real issue in the Valley, the need to expand the schooling because you've got so many school-age kids up there and they need classrooms, and that's one of the issues you're dealing with. Probably road improvement is another one.
Yeah, the public facilities, just because the growth has happened so fast there, and it's hard to keep pace with that with, limited governmental oversight and regulations and stuff. I certainly think we're doing the best job we can, and I think we're doing pretty well, but the challenges that we face day-to-day are definitely the public facilities and the infrastructure, so...
Do you think, Eileen, that the Valley is changing, moving away from being a bedroom community for Anchorage and really moving into kind of a Valley-centric kind of situation where people are living, working, and, recreating right there?
That's certainly what a lot of folks would like to have, you know, have occur in the borough is to have a better opportunity for jobs locally and, local governmental businesses and just so they don't have to commute. The recent economic development study that just occurred really showed that a lot of folks do commute, but we have a lot of opportunities in the Valley to expand the options for folks to work in the Valley and not have to go somewhere else for work.
I think that the recent stories I saw in the news about the state's growth, really it's slowed down a lot, but the Valley is still growing, even though the Valley has slowed down a little bit. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is correct.
So lots of change upon us, but I'd like to go back to Jerry and actually one of the most meaningful things that we talked about had to do with the community, the sense of community that grew among the colonists. And one of the things they seem to have brought with them, with their Midwest roots, were things like homemaker clubs. And we talked a little bit about how quickly those got started once these women landed here. Can you tell a little bit about that?
Well, yes, I could, and I think there were somewhere between 12 and 16 homemaker clubs, and they were rather located by neighborhood amongst the farms of different areas, different family groups, which made transportation much easier for the housewives to make it to the homemakers club meeting. They offered a broad exchange of ideas as far as talents for homemaking, skills for homemaking, and that would even include canning the numerous number of salmon that were caught as the salmon came into Ship Creek or Cottonwood Creek along the Goose Bay area. And it was a very lush place to fish back in the olden days. And in fact, even Pastor Bingle from the United Protestant Church, he would go out with some of the husbands and the older sons and so forth and help them catch the fish that would soon be canned and put away for the winter's larder. A big function amongst the families also and the community in general was the community meetings and especially the dances and the sport events, the basketball games at the school gymnasium, now known as the Borough Gymnasium. But in the early days, it also served as a community hall. So there were serious meetings held by the local utilities as they incorporated. Certainly the dances, the public dances, were a wonderful event. There would be a live band. And, for example, in the early days, Harry Lacko, who was one of the colonist husbands, was a special accordion player. It's been commented that he could have been a professional. He played his accordion. The Catholic priest, young Father Salzman, played the sax. Charlie Schaefer at one time played the trumpet. There would have been the piano. I mean, it was just a real nice community gathering. And the community was so supportive of the school children as they did their various programs and so forth. The churches did individual fundraising events during the year, which the community very kindly supported. And this would not have only been colonist families. This would have been the total community working together and coming together in fellowship. So good times, good memories.
I just want to remind our listeners we're talking about the Matanuska Colony and growth in the valley. My guests are Jerry Keeling, a daughter of Matanuska colonists, telling us stories from those days, and Eileen Probasco, who's the chief of planning for the Matsu Borough. So if you've got questions about either growth in the valley now or what it was like back in 1935, 36, 37, 38, when these colonists were plowing the fields and trying to get farms started, give us a call at 550-8433 or toll-free 1-888-353-5752. And you can also send an email to hometownalaska@kska.org. So, Jerry, one of the other things we talked about was there were some hardships, and I think, you know, it would be only right to sort of touch on those a little bit. It almost, when you look at the history, it looks as if public health wasn't quite where it needed to be when the colonists arrived. There were some deaths that first summer, right?
There were, yes, and you know, in actuality, for all the serious planning that went into designing the town of Palmer and envisioning it to be happening, there was no medical care in the plan and no hospital on the drawing board. And here we have this community of, say, 900 or more people, and their closest access to medical care was to go on the speeder car or on the train to Anchorage. And that first year, with the close proximity of travel for these rural children who had never been exposed to communicable diseases, there was a most serious outbreak of measles. Lorraine McKechnie Herman, for one, said she was just one big measle. And sad to say, from June 20th, the first child died here in the tent colony. On July 7th, the second, and July 9th, the third, and they were three little boys, each one named Donald, the oldest just under four, and the youngest just over a year. And with that sad event of those deaths, some of the parents contacted Eleanor Roosevelt with the message, "Our children are dying. We need your help." And it's just my wifely perspective, but that perhaps Eleanor pillow talked the president, because in short order, by the end of July, a hospital was on the drawing board and being planned for an area just across the street from where the United Protestant Church exists.
Now, Jerry, when I first met you, I thought you were the first baby born to any colonists, but that turned out not to be
quite accurate.
Yes, and so I want to clear the record here right now. You were the first baby born in that new hospital. Am I right about that?
That is correct, but I have to say that I was probably about the 20th or 25th baby for the colony, because all those other children were either born in their own family tents or in the tent hospital that Dr. Albrecht set up in July of 1935. So far cry, far different, yes.
Right. I think there were babies born in the tent city.
A number of babies. And in fact, the humorous joke was that for many years, the very best crop in the valley was the children.
That's great. That's great. That's really great. Yeah. Let's see. There was we don't have a whole lot of time left, but there's a fact that I want to get out in front of our listeners because to me it was pretty stunning. The deal that the colonists made to come up was they got 40 acres of land, they got some farm equipment, and they got a $3,000 loan that they were expected to pay back. And there's a historian, Jim Fox, who appears on this DVD, and he basically says that would equate to $350,000 loan today. And so it goes a long way to explain the anxiety a lot of those colonists had, because basically they were just building up debt while they were here. They essentially shopped at a company store, sort of. And
that's very true. Very true indeed. They, for that mortgage agreement that they signed once they were accepted to be a part of the project, was that they would pay these funds plus whatever other debt they had accrued at the company store, per se. For example, if they wanted to hire for a day a Caterpillar tractor to help clear an acre of land, that went on their loan debt. If they hired either man or equipment, you know, that went on their loan debt. However, for the mortgage debt, they did get their passage to Alaska. The government paid for each family to ship up to 2,000 pounds of personal goods of their choice and choosing, depending on what they owned to begin with. And then they had, by lottery drawing, chance to draw one of the 40-acre farm tracts if they were the topsoil quality land, or in other instances they were surveyed out to be 80 acres. But that was their option, and we do have an original contract at the Colony House Museum signed and completed by one of those original colonists, and one of the many treasures we have there.
Just to sort of give the let the other shoe drop here. It sounds from the history I've looked at that the experiment was essentially sort of over by 1939. Something like one third of the families were still there, but as Chuck Longston brought up, the war started, and suddenly there was a market for the farmers who were holding on, and so things began to disband. I think the cooperative stayed, stayed around, but I'm not sure that the structure that was there when they started was really continuing on after about 1939.
Oh, no, indeed it was. It was continuing on. The government pulled out in 1939, but the Met Valley Farmers Cooperative Association, I should say Cooperating Association, was the governing body that packaged and sold all the produce from the Valley Farmers. And actually, the Matanuska-made logo, which, sad to say, a few years ago went off the market, but now we have another Valley Creamery producing. Those are all legacies of the Matanuska colony and of those early colonists and their co-op pulling together.
Well, Jerry, on that note, we're really running out of time. I want to thank our guest, Jerry Keeling, daughter of a Matanuska colonist, and Eileen Probasco, chief of planning for the Matsu Borough, who also, you know, grew up in the valley and saw it change. And our topic was the 75th anniversary of the colonists. It's a rich, rich history. We were only able to touch on a little bit of it today, but I urge people to visit the Colony House Museum and to check our website for some of the history. Our hour went by so fast, but I'd like to thank you for joining me. Next week, Tika Ballas will host Hometown Alaska, talking to you about alternative circus entertainment and acts in town. That sounds like fun. Pat Yak is APTI's Vice President of News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program with assistance from Josh Edge. Thanks for listening. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program, additional information, and links to all the websites mentioned on today's show are available online at kska.org. Send us your comments and suggestions of things you'd like to talk about at Hometown Alaska, 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. This is KSKA Anchorage.